from deep inside your radio.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, once again, from New Orleans, Louisiana, I'm Harry Shearer with LeShow, and we're going. It's the new normal, as I've noted before. We're going back to it. As I observed on this broadcast last week, it is so fortuitous that the war ended just in time for sweeps, because otherwise, Survivor Iraq was not going to have really a chance at the sampling, let alone the loving that I think is in store for it. Some interesting items you may have... News from the rear, ladies and gentlemen, coming up. I'll read the trades for you. There's a tale of airport security on today's show. And because so many stations either preempted or truncated this feature last time it was attempted to be broadcast, one more attempt at the interview slash performance by Judith Owen coming up later in today's broadcast. First of all, from the New York Times, in assessing George W. Bush's potential opponents, Bush's advisors say John Kerry of Massachusetts could be presented as ideologically and culturally out of step. According to Mark Roscoe, the Republican national chairman, Kerry's going to have a hard time translating out of New England, says another Bush advisor of Kerry. Quote, he looks French. Unquote. He is, of course, Irish. Speaking of the Irish, ladies and gentlemen, you know, you contribute something major to the culture and you don't even get any credit for it. I don't know if you know this, but coming up in 247 days, one of the most potent accompaniments to a night out in Ireland will be gone as Dublin imposes a citywide ban on smoking in restaurants, bars, and other public places. That's news enough, newsworthy enough, certainly, given the smoky and drinky Irish culture. And you'd think that would be plenty newsworthy, but the Observer of London goes farther in its expression of shock and dismay at this development, thinking that Toronto might be a more likely candidate. Of course, they got their hands full. Hey, the WHO is suddenly becoming a controversial organization. The sugar lobby is after them in the city of Toronto. Who knew? They thought they were just sitting there being a World Health Organization. Anyway, back to Dublin and the story about the smoking ban in Dublin in today's London Sunday Observer and where credit gets mislaid. Quote, Dublin's ban is the nearest that the New York-style ban on smoking has come to England's shores. The New York-style ban on smoking, ladies and gentlemen. New York banned smoking, what was it, 4 days ago? In the United States is known as the California-style ban on smoking. But, of course, New York, well, we're all New Yorkers. So if it's from California, it is thereby from New York. You may have missed this. The U.S. State Department has unveiled an innovative new program to promote democracy in the Middle East, calling for athletic coaches to submit proposals for sports-related exchange programs. That's right. Very soon, Bobby Knight could be teaching chair throwing to the Sunnis. They're going to need those chairs, I'm going to tell you that right now. They have dismantled the Podium of Truth. I didn't even know they were calling it this. The podium at Doha in Qatar, whatever you want to call it, from whence the CENTCOM briefings were emitted every day during the war, during the late Great War. According to the Times of London, owned by Rupert Murdoch, always have to remind you of that, most slivers of information at the Central Command briefing came from the Brits. Of course, the Brits would think that, being Brits. Confirmation of the end of briefings at the Central Command headquarters came from British officers. The Americans wouldn't comment. British feel that their more relaxed approach to releasing information has been vindicated. Group Captain Al Lockwood, head of British media operations at CENTCOM, believes the American case has been damaged by its very stilted approach to news presentation. Other British officers were blunter, expressing irritation at being forced to bear the burden of briefing during the miserable start to the war when troops died in two helicopter crashes and a friendly fire incident. Brigadier General Vincent Brooks called it the podium of truth. A British officer at CENTCOM headquarters said he hoped that the visit by British Defense Secretary Geoffrey Hune to sort of preside at the close down would persuade the dozens of Japanese journalists still there to go home. He added, they're too polite to ask. And now, ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
Good apologies this week, I think. But what do I know? I'm just your friendly host. Why don't we start with the President of the United States? What do you think? Question from Tom Brokaw. Were you surprised by the degree of looting that occurred almost instantly following the end of the war? The President. No, I wasn't surprised at all. Question. You were not? Why? The President. I mean, there were people that hated the regime under which they lived. Question. But they went after hospitals and museums and... The President. I don't like that part. And that was, you know, the hospitals and museum were the absolute worst part. The good news is that the hospitals are now up and running. They've got enough medical supplies to take care of the people that need help. That museum was a terrible incident. I couldn't agree more with people who say, we're sorry that happened. So it's an apology by agreement more than by declaration. But he couldn't agree more that with the people who say we're sorry. The head of the FBI in Indiana publicly apologized this week for the detention of 8 Egyptian men from Evansville who were held as part of a terrorism investigation just weeks after the 9/11 attacks, saying the secretive detentions came at a time of unprecedented fear in the nation. FBI Special Agent Thomas V. Fuentes, that's a suspicious kind of name, maybe he should be detained, acknowledged that the detentions caused the men and their families distress and humiliation long after the government cleared them of suspicion. The situation that happened to you was horrible, Fuentes told former detainee Tarek Al-Basti during an evening meeting at the Islamic Center of Evansville, Indiana. On behalf of the FBI, I will apologize. He also promised to push through paperwork that would formally clear Al-Basti and the 7 other men detained. I will get all the records changed so they will reflect the investigation is over and that they are, in fact, not terrorists. You know, I think we should all ask the FBI for certifications of that. Look, not a terrorist. The head of the, I don't know what state this is, Louisiana, of course. The head of the Louisiana Wildlife Department apologized to a legislative committee after getting complaints from a legislator for using objectionable language at a recent hearing. I am sorry for the inappropriate language. Jimmy Jenkins, the Wildlife and Fisheries Secretary, said in his written apology to the committee. He said he thought the microphone was off when he used a vulgar term to explain that he did not care what the committee did with the bill. Representative Clara Beaudoin wrote a letter of a complaint to the governor asking him to recommend Jenkins publicly apologize for the remark. I'm sorry Ms. Beaudoin got upset about a part of a rat's anatomy, Jenkins said. I thought the mic was off. And it turns out he does give. At least about that. A irony in the news and an apology of the week. It's both. A prominent Republican fundraiser who once said former President Bill Clinton was a lawbreaker and a terrible example to our nation's young people has pleaded guilty in Baltimore Circuit Court to production of child pornography. Richard Anthony Delgaudio was sentenced to 2 years probation, admitted to taking lewd photographs of a 16-year-old girl he met in East Baltimore's Patterson Park in 2001. In some of the photos, court records show, he was engaged in sex with her. Delgaudio, is a frequent talk radio guest. This shouldn't hurt that. And national figure in conservative politics. This shouldn't hurt that. He's president of the Legal Affairs Council, a group that helped pay the legal bills of Oliver North. Spread it further, bub. In his pornography case, there was additional evidence that Delgaudio took erotic images of at least one other younger teenager, but that evidence was not admissible in court because police improperly stopped and searched Delgaudio. Oh, a technicality, eh? Largely because of that, prosecutors offered Delgaudio a plea agreement rather than taking the case to the jury. So like Oliver North himself, freed on a technicality, but apology nonetheless. Black lawmakers in Tennessee are calling for the resignation or censure of a state senator who made outrageous racial remarks, supposedly, on the floor of the Senate during a lottery debate earlier this week. Republican Senator David Fowler raised a question about how poor students qualifying for lottery scholarships would use a proposed $1,000 supplement. Where does the $1,000 go, he asked. Are we just going to write a check for $1,000 so they can snort it up their noses and buy kegs for fraternities, he asked, prompting groans from his colleagues. I think white kids use kegs, too, don't they? The Boston Athletic Association has apologized to residents of Hopkinton, Massachusetts, after runners used front lawns instead of portable toilets to relieve themselves before the start of the Boston Marathon. The Boston Athletic Association is very concerned. We want to take all active measures possible to prevent this in the future and year to year. And finally, singer Macy Gray has apologized to Paul McCartney for singing a poor rendition of With a Little Help from My Friends at a charity concert last year. She approached Sir Paul specifically to say sorry for her performance. Macy says, quote, "My brain was not with me. There were all these cops and firemen in front of me. That was like a weird dream, so I screwed up. I went the other day and apologized to him. I really meant it. I wasn't just trying to make conversation with him." So he said, that's all right. He was great, but he didn't disagree with me. This story runs on the wires the same day that Macy Gray's new single is released. That's got to be a coincidence. You couldn't plan that. Ladies and gentlemen, more special features. It's so copyrighted today, I can't even do the broadcast. Because now, yeah, it's still the show. I'm going to read the trades for you. From editor and publisher, the trade publication of the journalism business. Oh, actually, first of all, from the Columbia Journalism Review, the hoity-toity trade publication of the journalism business. And we'll get to editor and publisher in a minute. But I'll read both of them for you. That's the kind of guy I am, ladies and gentlemen. Television news executives have their orders: find more viewers, raise profits, and do it with fewer people in the newsroom. One result is that although news is everywhere today, much of it is blandly similar. Now some second-tier players in the broadcast world are heading down a path blazed recently in radio. Repackage news cheaply through centralized editorial operations, then beam it out to stripped-down stations. American News Network, the brainchild of Vincent Castelli, offers national news to independent stations that can't afford to produce it. It offers stations their own 5-minute local newscast, too, produced and anchored in Atlanta from local feeds and then fed back to local stations. The stations provide the raw video and copy through deals with local radio, newspapers, or others, and ANN polishes it up and has an anchor deliver it in front of a virtual skyline, a photo of whatever town the station purports to be in. Castelli says so far about 40 stations have signed on. Says Rick Rockwell, not the guy from who wants to marry a multimillionaire, I hope. He now teaches journalism at American University in Washington anyway. It's a business concept first. You're trying to find new business models to generate advertising in a very poor advertising climate. I can understand why it makes sense to these guys. On a slightly related topic, from editor and publisher, Federal Communications Commissioner Michael Copps has been brainstorming around the country, holding unofficial public hearings in advance of a scheduled June 2nd vote on proposals to eliminate the FCC's ban on owning newspapers and radio or TV stations in the same city. He repeats the same message everywhere. News outlets have failed to inform the public about these important issues. What a surprise. The media have not done a very good job of teeing up this debate for the American people. Whatever your side, someone's got to tell them what's up for grabs, he said. I haven't seen the first network news report on media ownership. It's an important issue that affects what you see and hear and read, and they're not reporting it. Perhaps that should be the only item of evidence submitted at the June 2nd hearing at the FCC. But FCC Chairman Michael Powell says he doesn't buy the argument that bigger national firms are always worse than smaller owners. He wants a numerical diversity index, ladies and gentlemen. No, it's not a quota. To gauge whether to let Rupert Murdoch buy more stations. And that's the way it looks when I read the trades for you. It is a copyrighted feature. News from the rear coming up shortly here on the show.
I've been to social functions down around Mobile, attended them in Richmond where they rock for real. I fell in on a barbecue in Birmingham. I went in like a lion and came out like a lamb. I messed around in Memphis, thought it was the end. Boy, what a session, thought I'd never mend. But I can tell you now, I never lived until that fine large meeting down in Louisville. Man, it was crazy. Show was crazy. They were bawling and brawling from Thursday night till Friday morning. It was crazy. Show was crazy. They were bawling and brawling from Thursday night till Friday morning. The meeting of the Order of the Western Star was moving in the groove at the refreshment bar. The Brotherhood and me was getting on first rate when in walked the most exalted potentate. He said, now, brothers, mind your manners, be polite. The sister membership is dropping in tonight. Just then the chicks arrive and Jack DeRay, Sam Hill at the good large meeting down in Louisville. Man, it was crazy. Show was crazy. They were bawling and brawling from Thursday night till Friday morning. It was crazy. Show was crazy. They were bawling and brawling from Thursday night till Friday morning. The room began a jumping like a pogo stick. I started in promoting me a real lush chick. I never jived a gal so fine in all my life when a big bass voice hollered, put her down, boy, that's my wife. The most exalted potentate was mighty burned. He kicked me in my belly while my back was turned. He pulled the leg right off the most exalted throne and beat my head like a xylophone. Man, it was crazy. Show was crazy. They were bawling and brawling from Thursday night till Friday morning. It was crazy. Show was crazy. They were bawling and brawling from Thursday night till Friday morning. The friendly brothers acted most unbrotherly. Fists began to fly and mainly right at me. The sisters started pulling hair with great concern, and no one made a motion to adjourn. I made myself an exit through a window pane. My feet was doing 60 when I hopped that train. The way I left them cats, they must be fighting still at the good large meeting down in Louisville. Man, it was crazy. Show was crazy. They were bawling and brawling from Thursday night till Friday morning. It was crazy. Show was crazy. I ain't never had so much fun before. But Jack, I ain't gonna do that no more. I hear they fighting still at good large meeting down in Louisville.
The shoes have been removed, so we can begin this segment of the broadcast, which originates in New Orleans, Louisiana, where I've interviewed several piano players and singers, mainly piano players. And so for this segment, since I detest nothing so much as nepotism, I've conducted a nationwide talent search and for the interviewee to be featured on today's broadcast. And I'm pleased and proud to announce that the winner is my wife. How did that happen? Nationwide talent search, and I end up with my wife. There'll be an investigation, but in the meantime, Miss Judith Owen, hello.
Hello.
Welcome.
Well, thank you so much. And it was a really hard talent search as well, and I had to do many things and jump through many loops, and some would say I actually had to sleep with some of the Well, one of the people.
One of the judges.
One of the judges.
Yeah.
And that's hard.
You also had to take your shoes off. It was your shoes that were
being
removed.
Those are my shoes that I removed because I can't play unless I'm barefooted. It's a primitive state that I've only just discovered that suits me, that that when I'm barefooted, I really do play much, much better and more animalistically.
Well, that's how primitive man played the piano.
Yes, it was, actually.
Barefoot.
Yes.
How did you come to the piano? I'm going to ask you some questions that I know the answer to. Because
and you won't mind if I don't stare at you while actually looking at while you're asking the questions, because it's just, I just keep wanting to say, well, you know that. I told you this so many times.
Well, I know,
mad?
But it's like being on television. You're being interviewed by people who already know the answer.
Well, Mr. Shearer, and by the way, can I just say I'm a huge fan of all your work.
Oh, thank you so much.
I came to the piano as a very young child because I come from a very musical family. My father's an opera singer, and there was always music in the house, and we are Welsh, but we were living in London by then, just outside London. And there was always singing and music in the house, and my sister was learning to play the piano, and she was playing a piece of Debussy. And I was listening to it, and I walked up to the piano, and I was four, and I copied the piece. And so my parents thought I was going to be some uberkind and a fantastic concert pianist, which of course is what you might think would happen. But it turns out that I have absolutely no ability to read music or any interest other than hearing other magnificent pianists playing beautiful music. I really just love writing and singing, and that was really it. So I was a horrible brat when I was very young because I refused to do this and had a few lessons. And I remember one teacher called Miss Duck, which is always difficult.
Miss Duck?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And
that was her. That was her actual surname.
Yes. And funnily enough, she had never been married, and very English, and great joy of learning to play the piano when somebody hits you on the back of the hand with a ruler every time you hit a wrong note or can't read. So I hated the whole thing. It was just revolting. So I was just left alone, and I wrote my little ditties.
You were writing little ditties as a child.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Do you remember what the first song you wrote was?
The first real song, and it's a kind of it's a little early in the interview to get dark and melancholy, but here we go. It's never too soon.
Never too early. No.
It's never too early to go down that way. So the first real song I ever wrote was fairly soon after my mother died, and it turned from being little ditties where I'd be just loving chords and loving making little songs up, and the first song became just a very immediate change, and I started to write in an incredibly emotional and real way. It was a song that if I played it today, which I won't, because it's absolutely too depressing for words, even by my standards. Was a real song, a real beauty. I could play it today, and it would still stand up.
Hmm. Why don't you play a song? Not that song, but a song of a less melancholy nature, perhaps. Barely.
Just barely.
Yeah, knowing your oeuvre.
Is that like my egg?
It is indeed.
Oh.
From maybe something from your new record, which...
My new...
Coincidentally, is coming out.
This is very strange. Yeah. And at the same time, I should be doing this.
Yeah,
it's amazing.
How does that happen?
The record is actually a companion piece to this live shows that I've been doing. So they just the musicians I've been working with went into a studio for 3 days and just knocked them out, and they do sound quite lovely, I must say. And I should have. You're the host. You are the host. And this once I'm going to.
You're going to defer. We do have this on tape. Well, since you were rehearsing it right before we started recording, why don't you play Hey Days?
I will play Hey Days.
Tell a little bit about the song. Like, who's it about?
It's not about me, which is... it's about... One of the reasons that I love... And I always dreamed about coming to America, was fascinated with it because I'm a huge movie buff, and especially black and white films, and I watch nothing else but AMC and Turner Classics. So I mean, I just love it. And as you well know, because you question me on this constantly as to how I could possibly watch the same film 20 times and not be bored. But being in LA and meeting people who just wax lyrical and tell amazing stories about what I consider to be the heydays of the film business and of the music business in LA is just astounding to me. I just never tire of it. And this was somebody who I met, who in fact was Liberace's manager, who's the father of a very dear friend of mine. And his name was Seymour Heller, and he was just the most fantastic character in the world. And we met in Nate Nall's, which is a deli in Beverly Hills. And I was trying to question him about Liberace's
proclivities.
Thank you. And he was just the greatest kind of most noble and loyal person by just saying he was a prince amongst men, he was a prince amongst men, which he kept repeating all the time. And I was like, yes, well, I know he's a prince, but I mean, what about other princes? And
What about the princesses?
And he would never spill the beans. He was just fantastic. And he just told me about Victor Mature, who had such a astounding appendage that when during the war they'd be going on the USO2s and stuff like that, and they'd be going from camp to camp, and so great was his appendage that he would be able to actually use it as some kind of bat, as like a baseball bat, and you could throw pieces of paper at him, flick them, and he would. So anyway, of course, that made me want to write a very deep and meaningful song.
I think the image is now fixed in our minds.
It's horrendous, isn't it?
We can now proceed to the actual song.
An Elizabeth once regaled me with tales of her father. In showbiz or Hollywood, that was the life he had seen. I sat amazed as she told me her the days of her childhood, and could hardly wait till the time when she'd tell me again. And one day we met, we sat in an old Jewish deli, and he spoke of a young Liberace and spitballs with Victor Mature. And I laughed and I flirted with this old boy who never talked dirty. And the more I suggested, the more he stayed loyal and pure. So give me the old boys with stories to tell of the way this town was. The films that I love, that I know so well, these were the died, 'cause it felt like the end of an era. The classiest guys were creating an exciting new world. And I thought of the pride in his voice as he spoke of his daughter, how his wife was the love of his life, how he called them his girls. So Elizabeth, please regale me with tales of your father. Showbiz or Hollywood, tell me the life that you knew. 'Cause you're cut from the cloth, you're a chip off the old block, my dear. And I'm glad that I knew him, and I'm so glad that I know you. Boys with stories to tell of the way this town was. The music I love that I know so well, these were the heydays. Give me the old boys with stories to tell of the way this town was. The films that I love that I know so well, these were the heydays.
Judith Owen performing live for us in the New Orleans Le Show Dome. Hey Days, it's on your record, yes, the new record?
Yes, it is.
Which is called Do the Job.
Oh, what? It's called 12 Arrows.
I've watched this process, and I have no understanding of it at all. So tell me, from your side of the equation, how does a song come to be for you?
Usually it's just, there's emotion in me about something. I go to the piano at some given time just because I feel the urge, because I hear something in my head, and I sit down, and it's usually out in about 10 to 15 minutes, piano-wise, and usually what happens is the meaning of the song, what it's really about, is usually it's in the hook, it's in the chorus somewhere, and that line, lyrically, words, they come out straight away. They come out this exactly the same time as the music does, so I know what it's about, and then it's a matter of just walking away and coming back to it a few times, and then just tightening things up and writing the lyrics to it. I have a great... what's the word for it?
Husband?
No, that wasn't it. I have a real love of writing beautiful melody with twisted lyric. Mm-hmm. How's that?
Yeah.
And a husband.
But it does also.
I have to say that.
Yeah, it does seem to come out sort of quickly, suddenly, magically.
It's as if you look back on it. There are times when I look back on my songs and look back at the lyrics, and I actually, months later, sometimes a year later, sometimes years, and I actually understand what the hell I was writing about. It's amazing, because it doesn't feel like it's...
feel like something you did.
No, it doesn't at all, and I'm sure that's what people refer to as channeling. I just think it's the unconscious self. I think it's when you're in the most pure and zone-like place, when this stuff just comes out of you. It's a most exquisite feeling in the world when you write. For me, it really is.
Play something else from the new bunch of stuff, if you would.
Well, this I think I'll do something which is has a little bit of a rhythmic quality to it, so that the whole show doesn't become like the hanky hour. Although that could mean something else too.
Mm-hmm.
But that would be fine. This is called On Me, and it's about people downloading their stuff on you. I do bad, thinking that you might be a man. 'Cause you looked so strong, but you act so young. I guess that you don't understand anything. I guess that you just don't understand. And you told me of your story, how you love something finer than me. Well, you would not know Christ if you met in paradise. So, darling, don't put the blame on me. On me. You have been hurt all of your life. Lord, I know that you've been neglected from birth. You're an unhappy man. Happy wife, unaware of your own lack of self-worth, unaware of your own lack of self-worth. And you tell me of your stories, how you love something finer than me. Well, you would not know Christ if you met in paradise. So darling, don't put the blame on me. To live alone, an unhappy king in a country of one, governing ghosts from your throne. You're governing ghosts from your throne, and you tell me of your story, how you love something finer than me. Well, you would not know Christ if you met in paradise. So darling, don't put the blame on me. And you tell me of your story, how you love blame on me.
Judith Owen on me. Excuse me? What? What did he say?
Are you having trouble with the knobs?
Always.
Oh.
You mentioned your father and your exposure to opera at an early age. What other musical influences can you trace? I mean, who else were you listening to growing up?
Well, my father is a pretty unusual classical musician because... Although he felt that opera was, you know, the be-all and end-all and really the most, you know, the highest level of singing that you could ever do, he was listening when he was a young boy to people like Nellie Lutcher and Jelly Roll Morton and Albert Ammons.
Mm.
And he was obsessed with stride piano and barrel house and all that kind of stuff. And he had these incredible 78s that he'd collected in Wales. How bizarre is that? When he was a really young child. Then he got in totally into R&B, and that was in there as well. But it was always piano. It was always about the piano and the voice. And so, funny enough, when I came to New Orleans for the first time, we'd been listening to the radio. He'd listened to the radio, and he called me and said, "You'll not believe this incredible person that I've just heard on the radio." And I recorded as much of it as I could. And I don't know the name of the person, and you've got to hear this. And he sent me a tape, and it was just blinding. And then when I came over here and went to New Orleans Jazz Fest for the first time, it there standing in front of me on a stage was Johnny Adams, and that was exactly who we'd been listening to years before. And then I got to see Nellie Lutcher when she came to play in L.A. at the grand age of about 85, I think.
Oh, you're younger than that. Oh, you mean Nellie Lutcher, I'm sorry.
Yes, yeah. Yes. I want to be 85 with a pair of gloves playing piano. I mean, that actually is what I want to be. And she was singing Fine Brown Frame and just as fabulously and flirtatiously as she always has. And then the first, I'd say, astounding influence apart from Frank Sinatra and Ella Fitzgerald, that I was, you know, I'm a Nelson Riddle lunatic and I would listen to that stuff until my ears were bleeding. But truly the biggest influence upon me was Stevie Wonder. And when I first acquired Songs in the Key of Life, again, just wore the damn thing out. And he was the most exciting artist I'd ever heard, vocally, keyboard-wise. There just didn't seem to be any boundaries to this man. He just did absolutely whatever he thought sounded great. And that was what it was all about. And it was so inspiring. I've never quite got over him. And now that I've come here and seen him play live, and actually been in the ear, nose, and throat doctor's waiting room when he walked through, and I just felt my life had actually been completely, you know, satisfied in every way possible.
Those are the real Hollywood thrills.
Those are the thrills.
When you're sitting in the same doctor's office as your idols.
Yes. So him, Aretha Franklin, early Elton John, because it was just so unbelievably great. These are all people to me. I realized that everyone that's important, all the music that I listen to this day, are all piano playing singers. Randy Newman, early Aretha, just because the piano was so prominent, because she was a pianist, that was in her soul. That's what really, really just drives me crazy. And then I really thought about the classical music that I listened to all the time as well. And my probably up there is Rachmaninoff, and so there's no surprising that I'm obsessed with pianos. What can I say?
Mm-hmm. You want to hit the piano again?
Yes.
Indulge your obsession in
I would indulge my obsession with the Celtic side of me.
Oh, yeah.
Because the part that I suppose influenced my soul the most was the utter melancholic state of Celtic people and of Welsh people in particular. Well, I know them to cry in their beers quite regularly. This is a song called Conway Bay.
There's a word in it that you should explain to the audience.
Yeah, the word is Candacraig, and... We went to Scotland, and Kandacraig was this castle, an astounding castle, and a town and a castle, and we were there, and I set off from this place on a road trip that followed my childhood across to the west coast, to the lochs, which I used to go to a lot when I was a kid. And I still feel like just some of the most spiritual places in the world are in Scotland. And then down into Wales, down into Conwy Bay, which is where we used to holiday when I was a child. And then all the way down through Wales, which is pretty shocking, I think, because everything is the smallest roads you've ever seen in your entire life, so it takes forever to get through Wales, but it is exquisite. And down to where I'm from. And
say the name of the town you're from.
Llanelli.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, wipe off your radios, and here's Judith to sing.
I took the road from Kandacraig to the Western Isles, down into Conwy Bay. I took the road to heathered hills, put my arms around the land that would haunt me still. I took the road from Kandacraig to the Irish Sea, down to my mother's grave. I took the road through childhood times and put my arms around the girl who was always mine. And the bridges we burn, they make life so beautiful. They're the places we yearn for when we're so far away. All those bridges we burn that make life so beautiful. The childhood, sunny days, rainy days. So I took the road from Kandacraig to the Western Isles, down into Conwy Bay. I took the road through heathered hills, and at last I cried, ancient land, you own me
Time now on the show for News from the Rear. Dale in London, the British Ministry of Defense has offered all British soldiers returning from Iraq tests for traces of depleted uranium in their bodies. Can there be a new syndrome at hand? The test should determine whether the soldiers have an increased risk of kidney and lung cancer. The tests were commissioned after the British Royal Society issued a warning on the dangers of exposure to high amounts of DU. A spokesman for the Defense Ministry has claimed, however, that the risks associated with depleted uranium are much lower than the risks of other military operations. Test results and information on the use of DU weapons are to be made public. Military experts estimate about 2,000 tons of depleted uranium were used during the recent unpleasantness. The Times of London says reports of weapons of mass destruction leading up to the war in Iraq were greatly exaggerated. The most dramatic claim was that, at least on the part of the Brits, was that Saddam military planning allows for some of the weapons of mass destruction to be ready within 45 minutes of an order to use them. The British Defense Secretary this week in an interview backed away from that claim when asked if they had weapons ready to use in 45 minutes, why they didn't use them. Britain's Telegraph newspaper today, Sunday, has unearthed documents sitting around in the rubble of Baghdad planning for a meeting between a representative of Al-Qaeda and a high-ranking Iraqi official, trumpeted by the Telegraph as proof of the long-rumored link between Saddam and Osama. Another British newspaper said representatives from the Iraqi security operation are known to have traveled to Kandahar in the late 90s to build links with Al-Qaeda. Most analysts, this newspaper, The Observer, says, believe the ideological differences between the Iraqis and the terrorists were insurmountable. The talks are thought to have ended disastrously for the Iraqis. Bin Laden rejected any kind of alliance, preferring to pursue his own policy of holy war. We'll see. Third week in a row, the Telegraph has published documents unearthed in the rubble. The unprotected, unguarded rubble of former Iraqi government ministries. Newt Gingrich did this week what Tom Daschle did back in March. Said the diplomacy failed before the war. The Republicans attacked Daschle. Gingrich has now gone silent. Will not comment. Following a couple appearances on Fox, of course. He's not granting any interviews on the topic, said Gingrich's spokesman, Rick Tyler. In this case, a non-spokesman. Gingrich was surprised by the degree and intensity of reaction to his speech attacking the State Department's diplomatic efforts. It's understood in Washington that Gingrich, who's a pal of Donald Rumsfeld and sits on the same defense policy board as Richard Perle, might have been a soldier in the internecine warfare between the Pentagon and the State Department. Favorite story from the rear this week. As Iraqi Shiite demands for a dominant role in Iraq's future mount, Bush administration officials say they underestimated the Shiites' organizational strength and are unprepared to prevent the rise of an anti-American Islamic fundamentalist government in the country. Rumsfeld on Friday issued a statement saying the democracy is not going to be hijacked by these guys, but officials told the Washington Post, we were unprepared. U.S. administration, according to these officials, failed to fully appreciate the force of Shiite aspirations. And the administration is now concerned that those sentiments could coalesce into a fundamentalist government. Some administration officials, says this article, were dazzled by Ahmed Shalabi, the prominent Iraqi exile who is a convicted felon in Jordan, but he's a Shiite and an advocate of a secular democracy. It is a complex equation. The U.S. government is ill-equipped to figure out how this is going to shake out, said a State Department official. I don't think anyone took a step backward and asked, what are we looking for? That could be interpreted as the State Department shooting back. And ABC News says, to build its case for war, the Bush administration argued that Saddam had weapons of mass destruction, but some officials now privately acknowledge the White House had another reason for war, a global show of American power and democracy. ABC News reporting this as news this week. What is it the kids say? D-U what? Oh yeah, D-U-H. Not depleted either. News from the rear, ladies and gentlemen. There's still no front. There's no front anymore, but there's still a rear. In New Orleans with Judith Owen, as we finish up this conversation, you're your goals are just to keep doing this, but to have more people become aware of it?
I love how it's amazing how you can ask these questions and sound so believable when you know, in fact, the answer to everything. And let me get professional. My goals in life are to absolutely be the best artist I can be and to keep doing what I do and not to be afraid of being different and unique. This is what I do, and I have to just work my fabulous behind off to just reach as many human beings as I can. So
world domination is the thing.
World domination completely.
Okay, so the record is called 12 Arrows.
It's called 12 Arrows. And I should just point out that there are two quite phenomenal duets on it that I'm very proud of, and one is the whole point of the record was just to do, not to do multiple takes, not to do any of that stuff. I really am very bad at this. I believe in the Frank Sinatra, it's the first will be your best, and it usually is, if I've bothered to learn the lyrics. And we added to that a couple of really, I thought, quite spectacular, again, just let's get together and do one take of a couple of duets. And Julia Fordham did the duet of That Scares Me, and the second duet is with Richard Thompson. They are two remarkable artists.
Judith, people ask me this question all the time, so I'll ask it of you. What is it that you like so much about New Orleans?
Most of the world is really driven, I feel, by the guitar. And this place is absolutely still devoted to the piano. And there's some of the finest piano players in the world here. That was the first thing that hit me, of course, was the music. And the second thing that hit my stomach was the food. And then I managed to figure out how you actually eat the food without turning into a juggernaut.
Oh, nicely done.
Thank you. We just found out what it means. Lord of the World. Mm. 16-wheeler Lord of the World. Carried Krishna. Something. So I would say music, food, absolutely architecture. And you can't say enough about how fabulous the people down here are. And how, you know, walking across the street takes 20 minutes because everybody wants to chat, and I want to chat too. And I love it. What's not to like about that?
Okay. That would be my list. favor us with another tune.
Well, we all have those terrible days when you can't even make it out your own front door, and life seems to get in your way. And is it any wonder that sometimes it's easier to hide under the covers? So when somebody calls you and they say they understand, it's like a hand across water, a hand across the water, a sister, brother, father, mother, you are all, and you turn me around, cause we all have those terrible times when you want something so bad your insides ache, and you try to eat your breakfast but there's tears on the flakes. And is it any wonder that sometimes it's easier to cry than to recover? Somebody calls you and they say you're not alone. It's like a hand across the water, a hand across the water, and sister, brother, father, mother, you are all, and
you turn me around. You turn me around. You know that I like it. Don't ever, ever have to stop and think about it, darling. Try to be strong, but you're shaking inside. And you try to be a grown-up, but you feel more like a motherless child, darling. Is it any wonder that when somebody calls you in there, they say they understand? It's like a hand across the water. A hand across the water. And sister, brother, father, mother, you are all. And you turn me around.
Judith Owen appears this coming Saturday night in New York City. For more information on her, www.judithowen.net. Ladies and gentlemen, that's going to put the cork back in this week's edition of Le Show. It won't keep, of course, but the program returns next week at this same time over these same stations and on your computer whenever you want it at www.harryshearer.com and kcrw.com. My thanks today to Sean Hurley for playing bass with Judith, to John and Drew at Piety Street Studios here in New Orleans, and to Bob Dunn at WWL-TV in New Orleans for simultaneously helping today's Le Show broadcast get on the air and working on his nails. The email address for this broadcast is lemail, L-E-M-A-I-L, at interworld.net. Le Show Internet Services by Steve Mack. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless. So long from New Orleans. Happy Jazz Fest.